Good morning. I'm Astoria Mayor Arlene Lemire, and I would like to welcome everyone to the City of Astoria for Senator Wyden's 2018 Clatsop County Town Hall. Now, please welcome Senator Ron Wyden.
Should I use that?
Yes, over there.
You might need that one for a while.
Thank you so, so much. And I think we also ought to recognize Arlene. You know, if you're mayor of a small town on the Oregon coast, you get a lot of perks. You get a mansion, and you get a driver, and I understand she's got a great cook, so it's Saturday night, we could probably come over and have a wonderful salmon or something like that. And you guys know I'm kidding. She's doing this for one reason, and that is she just loves this community. So let's give Arlene a big round of applause for doing this. And I just barreled in through the back, and I saw her cheerful countenance. I said, it's going to be a good day, so I thank her. How many of you have never been to one of our town meetings before? Raise your hands. So we got a fair number of newcomers. Well, what happens is I usually start off with a little comment, you know, like maybe 45 minutes or so. And people really enjoy it. And there are a couple of folks over there who think I'm serious. Their face got all pale. I said, oh my God, what am I stuck with on Saturday morning? No. This is part of the pledge that I made to Oregon. We were choosing our first new senator in 30 years, and I said, if I have the honor to be chosen, we'll have an open meeting in every county in Oregon every year that I serve in the Senate. So I think we're now on town meeting about number 865 or somewhere in there, and it's just so important to do this the way the founding fathers wanted us to do it. Here it is. It's a Saturday morning on the coast. A lot of things you could be doing besides educating me. So I really appreciate everybody coming out. I'm not going to be reading from any teleprompters or any speeches or any of that kind of thing. But we do have a little bit of business, and I think I see my friend Debbie Boone right up front. And Debbie, could you come up? We kind of need you for a little business, a little bit of business. So, I think, where is Debbie? Oh, there she is, okay. Some of you probably know that a lot of us were campaigning to try to keep Representative Boone from retiring. We didn't think it was a very good idea because we have watched her wonderful service all of these years. Outside the legislature, by the way, Children's Hospital Foundation Board, Head Start, working to prevent child abuse. I'm not sure everybody knows she was a volunteer firefighter for 16 years. I mean, she's kind of the bionic woman. She is just involved in everything. And she worked even before being a representative for 16 years in the Capitol. And obviously she took on a lot of issues that everybody cares about on the coast, the Oregon Resilience Plan after the Japanese tsunami, a lot of emergency improvements. That battle is still going on, folks. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened this week, but I just thought it was important, given the fact that we have been unsuccessful in persuading Representative Boone to not retire. I thought it was important today that we just take a minute, recognize her for her extraordinary service, not just to the Oregon coast, but for the entire state of Oregon. And one of the things I get to do from time to time is get a flag flown over the Capitol. And it is a great, great honor for me with some regret, because I wished that I was just giving her a flag for another one of her great accomplishments rather than the fact she's retiring. And I think it's really appropriate that we show Representative Boone how grateful we have been for her incredible service all these years. Debbie.
Well, thank you, Senator. I have always wanted one of these. This is really, really cool. Thank you. And I have been privileged to serve as long as I have in both capacity as a state legislator and a legislative assistant to seven different lawmakers. And as it happens, the last 2 years, I've been my husband's full-time caretaker as he battled brain cancer. Until he died recently. And so that's been really tough, and that was one of his last requests of me, was to retire and take some time for me so that I could, it wasn't the retirement we planned, put it that way, and so I could take some time for me and do some things that we didn't get to do together. So, and everybody knows I travel to Sweden as often as I can. That's the home of my ancestors on my mother's side. And I haven't been there for 3 years, and I've lost three more relatives over there, so it's time for me to go back. And I will finish this term out, which finishes the second Monday of 2019. And so I'm still there. I may be a lame duck or a short timer, as everybody's gone around the offices in Salem and marked the short timer button. But It's been a privilege, and I look forward to in a couple of days going back down to Salem and having our short session, which we're still not sure what all is going to happen. So it'll be interesting. So thank you all very much for this honor, and thank you, Senator, very much. It means
good.
A lot.
All right, Debbie, thank you, and I'm also, so you should know, going to start scheming and plotting. Because there are all kinds of ethics rules or something. Maybe we can make her one of those people, you know, 50 cents a year, one of those kind of big, you know, wage operations. She's too talented, so I'm sure a lot of people in the audience share my view. We are not going to let such a wonderful person as Debbie Boone escape. We're going to let her retire, but she's not going to escape. Debbie, thank you. No subjects. No subjects off limits. There are a couple things going on back there in the nation's capital. And I'm not going to give any speeches. I'm going to also at some point give you a little update on what happened this week in energy and natural resources with respect to tsunami preparedness. And you might have heard I had some spirited views on the issue with some of the Trump people on that. But let's just go right to what everybody wants to talk about, Arlene. And no subjects off limits.
Three, two, eight, and 319. Raise your hands if you have one of those numbers. Kathleen?
Yikes. First of all, thank you, Senator Wyden, for coming. I really appreciate your town hall meetings. As a new county commissioner this past year, I've learned, my name is Kathleen Sullivan.
Right.
I represent District 4. And I learned how much money comes from the federal government to fund programs on the local level. I am on the Northwest Senior and Disability Board, and I'm very concerned with this tax bill that just passed. And perhaps you can talk about that. I don't know if people realize how much that has the potential to affect our daily lives here. Thank you.
I'm the senior Democrat on the tax writing committee, and I think this proposal that was passed and was signed into law is one our country is going to regret and regret deeply. And let me kind of walk you through a couple of the key elements. The first and most serious is that in order to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax relief to multinational corporations that are already awash in cash, the Republicans, because this was a Republicans-only bill, borrowed $1.5 trillion to pay for this. And by the way, foreigners own about 30% of the debt, so this also has some economic ramifications there as well. So the first thing that happened, really even before the bill passed, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, looked up and said, oh my goodness, we have such a big debt. What are we going to do about it? We're going to go back and go after Medicare and Medicaid and the safety net that is so important on the Oregon coast. So I think it was a very flawed bill. I had a bipartisan bill, actually the most recent one, was written with Dan Coats, now a member of the president's cabinet, and I didn't think this was very complicated. I think we should have targeted the relief to the middle class, because the middle class drives 70% of the American economy. Henry Ford, the great auto industrialist, said, I want to be successful. I founded this company. For me to be successful, my people have to have enough money to buy my cars. So the relief should have been targeted to the middle class, A. B, we should have expanded the earned income tax credit in a way that really would have provided relief to the working poor. People are working hard day in, day out, playing by the rules. And third, we could have had some changes in the tax code as it relates to business to ensure that our companies are going to be competitive in a global economy. But there's no reason to have hundreds of billions of dollars go to multinational corporations who already are showing that looks like they're going to spend it on dividends and stock buybacks and the kinds of things that don't relate to more good-paying jobs. So we'll now watch over the next few months what happens, but the claims that the sponsors have made are already not ringing so true. They just claimed that everybody was going to have bulging paychecks, just bulging, you know, paychecks. And a lot of people are telling me already they're not seeing too much in what they've gotten, you know, out of this so far. So we're following this. The Oregon Legislative Office, in fact, Debbie, I think the people you work with said that the typical filer might get $870 annual, I think was the number. And then we said, well, let's do some math here. If you got a little under $900 a year under this and you divided that into two paychecks a month, you might get $35 extra in your paycheck. Now, nobody's going to minimize getting any money at all, but let's make no mistake about it. What Oregon middle-class folks are going to get is going to get dwarfed by what the multinational companies are going to get, and what the people who got the estate tax abolished are going to get, and what these people who are going to game the pass-through laws are going to get. So we'll have to see here over the next few weeks as the government adjusts withholding tables and things like that. But I can tell you, there's no way what middle-class families in Oregon are going to get is anything but dwarfed by what the powerful, the well-connected, and the multinational companies are going to get. And we already know from what Paul Ryan has said that this is going to create more debt, and Paul Ryan's plan for dealing with the debt isn't too good for the Oregon coast.
Okay, did someone else have one of the other numbers that I called? Oh, back in the back, okay, great. And I will call two more also to follow that. 323 and 288. So if you get your questions in order if you have one of those numbers. Thank you.
So I was here last year and I asked a similar question and I kind of got some stares for it, but I've noticed over the past year it's hard to get involved directly with government as a teenager. And I'm wondering if there's some way that I could get involved directly with my city, state, or federal government. Where do I go next?
The question, and it's a particularly good one for young people, because we've seen over the last few months an explosion of young people running for office. So I don't know if you're interested in something like that, but I'll tell you all across the country what's happened, and I can't possibly guess what the reason is behind it, but young people are getting involved in running for office. What I've always said is that particularly for young people, I think the best path is to find an issue that you really feel strongly about. For me, that was senior citizens. That was what really drove me into public service. You know, I had spent my high school years, ill-spent years, dreaming of playing in the National Basketball Association. That was a ridiculous idea, because I was too small and I made up for it by being really slow. So I did get a college scholarship, but I wasn't going to get to play in the NBA. But as I got out of school, I fell in love with the cause of trying to help older people with really small incomes. And back then, there was a lot less for seniors than there is now. You know, back then, if a town had a lunch program, like if a town like Astoria gave seniors a lunch, that was considered a big deal. You didn't have transportation, you didn't have a lot of the home health kinds of services, help with pharmaceuticals, that kind of thing. So that was my first love. Now, the other thing, of course, is if you're interested in, we always try to work with students being interns in our offices, both in Oregon and Washington. So, potential candidate, finding an issue that you really care deeply about, and then we're especially interested in having young people from the coast being interns in our office. Fritz Graham is here. Where is Fritz? He's floating around somewhere. He is really the gold standard for dealing with federal issues on the coast. And so if you're interested in being an intern in one of our offices, Fritz Graham will be floating around. There he is. I've introduced him. Fritz is so popular that once there was like a newspaper endorsement, and the newspaper endorsement said, Ron Wyden's okay. You know, he's fine. We're fine with Ron. But what we really like is having Fritz Graham helping us. So hanging out with Fritz Graham will be a good way to get interested in federal issues as well. And I appreciate you doing it.
You need this. Hi, thank you for coming. First, our neighbors across the river in Pacific County, Washington, have been hit hard recently by ICE agents in some very cowardly fashions. That's really close to home, and that disturbs me. But what disturbs me more is this weekend, while he's at Mar-a-Lago, and after a long day of golf and sitting around in his posh surroundings, if he gets a hankering to start firing somebody and fires Rod Rosenstein, what do we do? We cannot do nothing. What do we do? Do we hit the streets? What do we do if this is starting to get closer to Robert Mueller and his investigation?
Well, let's talk about... Let's talk about the Nunes memo and what's happened the last few days, and then I want to make my way to the question of Rod Rosenstein and Robert Mueller. And I was struck late last night, I saw an interview with Devin Nunes, of all people, who said, Rod Rosenstein's going to be in his job for a long time. And I just thought to myself, Wow. How do I reconcile that with everything that Mr. Nunes had been all about? But let's kind of talk about where we are. First, I have been struck as the House pursued this really flawed idea of, in effect, trying to create a sort of smoke screen for what's really going on and how far-fetched they would be. I mean, what they have wanted to do from the very beginning is to divert attention from the fact that people close to Donald Trump who have been involved with the Russians have pled guilty and have been indicted for issues associated with that connection with the Russians. And we are talking about Mr. Papadopoulos, and we're talking about Mr. Flynn, and we're talking about Mr. Manafort, and we're talking about Mr. Gates, and I haven't even said anything yet about Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner. So what this is really all about is trying to take attention away from that and trying to create all of this smoke, this huge smoke screen surrounding the FBI and the Justice Department and the warrant process. And let me just give you a couple of reasons why I tell people they ought to be a little skeptical of all this. The first deals with the fact that Mr. Nunes just threw in the trash can all the principles of basic fairness. And I want to be very specific about it. I have these town meetings, 860 of them, and I go, last year I had 80 of them. Nobody has ever done 80 town meetings in the history of Oregon. I just thought the interest was so great that I should really be out there. And in counties where Donald Trump won by 20%, and in counties where Hillary Clinton won by 20%, everybody believes that you ought to have basic fairness, and both sides have a right to be heard. What was the first thing Devin Nunes did in connection with this? He said, we're not going to do that in our investigation. You'll hear our side, and you're not going to hear anything from the Democrats, the minority. So that's what happened yesterday. And people have stood up at my meetings. In fact, I had one last night, and they said, such and such happened, and Mr. McCabe, bum. And I said, respectfully, sir, that was not a bipartisan inquiry. That was what Mr. Nunes said happened. That's not necessarily A, what happened, or B, what Mr. Schiff, the ranking Democrat, might have said. So this whole thing just completely flunks the fairness test. That's number one. Number two, it is at its heart a debate about something called FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. I'm on the Intelligence Committee. My older child calls it the so-called Intelligence Committee. But Mr. Nunes suddenly became a great advocate of transparency and privacy and protecting individual rights. And I said, let me see if I can get this straight here. He's saying that there's been this big violation of privacy rights by the Justice Department, the FBI, all of these officials under the FISA process where there in fact was a warrant. And Mr. Nunes had just pushed through over my opposition within like the last 3 weeks, a reauthorization of the FISA Act so as to allow for more, not less, more surveillance of law-abiding Americans without warrants. This is Mr. Nunes, and then he stands up in front of the American people and says, I'm Mr. Transparency and Accountability and your protector against FISA abuse. I mean, I'll tell you, the only transparency associated with what happened in the House was the hypocrisy of what this was all about. Now, here's where things are with respect to Robert Mueller. I think firing Robert Mueller will trigger a full-scale constitutional crisis in America. I think all over America, people are going to be up in arms, and I want to tell you why. Robert Mueller is a Republican. By the way, all the commotion with the FBI and the Justice Department, Christopher Wray is a Republican, and he was appointed by Donald Trump. So kind of when you're done scratching your head, see if you can make sense out of that. But firing Robert Mueller without cause will, in my view, trigger a constitutional crisis from one end of the country, from one end of the country to another. I think there will be a push by some in the House of Representatives for impeachment. We'll see how far that goes, but I think you'll certainly hear about that. Senators who, by the way, Republican senators have wanted nothing to do with this newness process in the House. You probably have seen there hadn't been a one standing up saying, well, I think this was, you know, the way to go. I think you'll see bills in the Senate to try to protect the office. Some of them will say you're entitled to this before you're fired, you're entitled to this after you're fired, but I think there will be bipartisan proposals. Bob Mueller, a Republican, served in Republican administrations, Democratic administrations, a decorated war hero who, when he was appointed, you know, huzzas from Democrats, Republicans, all across the political spectrum, has done this inquiry by the book. And I'll just close by way of saying that on the key issues, and as you know, there is a question of obstruction of justice, there's a question of collusion. I personally have spent most of my time on issues I call follow the money, because I think that's crucial. You may have seen just yesterday that I called for an investigation into these stories that talk about, at least the stories talk about, relations between Russian insiders, Mr. Putin, and using shell companies to manipulate our elections. And I did that just, you know, yesterday. So whether it's collusion, whether it's following the money and financial abuses, you also have to remember that this issue really goes to the question of obstruction of justice. That is a fundamental question here. And again, this was brought on by the president. When the president sat down with Lester Holt, and I don't know if any of you have seen the interview, but you might want to just, you know, pull it up on YouTube. When the president sat down with Lester Holt, he said to Lester Holt, I fired Comey to make the Russia investigation go away. And I turned to my wife and I said, he said that on television? I mean, if that had been said in private, I think there would have been real legal consequences. But he said on national TV to Lester Holt of NBC, I fired him to make the Russian investigation go away because I didn't think there was anything to it. So that's what triggered this. Pardon me? Well, first thing, I never speculate on kind of business that we work on in the committee, because it's against the rules, and I feel, you know, when you're the one on the end of 14-1 votes in the Intelligence Committee, you pay a lot of attention to the rules, so I'll leave it at that. But there are two parts to this inquiry. Bob Mueller works on the criminal side, okay? That's his job. He is a prosecutor. He's brought in like 15, 16 people. By the way, telltale assessment there, not from classified matters, of the 16 people Bob Mueller brought in, almost all of them are experts at financial fraud prosecution. So a little bit of a pause there. So he works on the criminal side. My job is different. I sit on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. It is my job to tell the American people how the Russians sought to undermine our democracy. And you've probably seen I've been in some pretty spirited battles with the leadership there as well, because they haven't been interested in follow the money issues. And I've said, folks, how can you not be interested in follow the money issues on the Senate Intelligence Committee? Because following the money is counterintelligence 101. The way you compromise people is through money. This is not rocket science. So there are a lot of questions about what's going to happen at the Intelligence Committee as well, and setting dates to wrap it up. I've been saying at every county meeting throughout this state, I want to say it in Clatsop County, so that everybody's clear, as long as I am Oregon's guy on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the Russia investigation will not get swept under the rug. Period. It is not going to get swept under the rug on my watch. Period. It is too important to America, and it is not going to be, it's not going to be swept under the rug. So that's probably a longer answer than you wanted, but that's kind of a take on where things are.
Thank you. Okay, there was one other number already called. Is someone ready to speak? If not, I'll call two others. 312 and 314.
Thank you for being here, Senator. We really appreciate it, especially given the, you know, hide yourself in your office of so many other representatives that aren't letting people speak to them. My question is about the fact that the founders always counted on our legislative body to be a guard and a reigning force for the executive. I don't think they ever anticipated anything as extreme as the one we have in that office now. And it seems like the only guards we have right now really working for us is the judiciary branch. So I'm wondering, since I read an article by Preet Bharara, as you know, who is the U.S. Attorney for New York, who was fired by President Trump, he is trying to organize support for codifying a lot of the things that reasonable people assumed would be followed by presidents and they have in the past. And he wants to codify things such as requiring anyone occupying the office or running for the office of president to release their full tax returns, to have divestiture of their financial investments, to really finally get rid of nepotism in the executive branch. In other words, not to flout the things and the norms that for 200 years we have assumed that honorable people occupying that office would follow. So my question is, Senator, what can you do to support Preet Bharara's movement, and is that a possibility that we can have some real protections in the law in case we get clones Trump someday that comes and is a disgrace and a dishonorable person in the White House?
He's a good man, and yes, I have just picked up that he's going to do this, and we'll be reaching out. I, for example, have been working as the senior guy on the Finance Committee to have every president disclose their tax returns, period. And I started early in the 2016 campaign because the president had said that he would disclose his tax returns. And remember, there were all these candidates running, several Democrats, lots of Republicans, and everybody disclosed their taxes. And I watched, and the only one who didn't disclose his taxes was Donald Trump. So I began to speak out and said, hey, for 40 years now, since Watergate, everybody running for president or occupying the office would disclose their taxes. It was the lowest ethical bar. It was not a high ethical bar. It was the lowest ethical bar, and that Donald Trump was throwing this aside as well. So I said, I hope that he'll do it. Nothing happened. So along about, towards June, July, August, somewhere in there, I said, it sure looks like he's dragging his feet. I'm going to introduce legislation, federal legislation, which I have introduced again after he was sworn in, to require a president to disclose their taxes. And I said at the time, I sure hope it isn't necessary, that we won't have to pass this law because Donald Trump will finally do what everybody else did, which is disclose his returns. Nothing happened. So in September, I went to the floor and I asked, in effect, for what's called unanimous consent so we could bring it up and have a debate on requiring presidential candidates to do it, and the Republicans objected to that. So now my legislation has, like, I think 21, 22 sponsors in the Senate. A number of Republicans have said they think he ought to disclose his tax returns. Some of them have said, well, it ought to apply for the next election rather than this one. I mean, there have been all kinds of excuses. But I just don't pass it. I don't think it passes the smell test. And it figures very much into the follow the money issue. And let me connect the dots for everybody. Over here, you have their statement, the family statement, that in 2008 and 2009, much of their portfolio was Russian money. This was their statement. And that was a time when it was hard to get money. That's a big admission. 2008, 2009, Trump family says much of our portfolio, Russian money. Then you go to the top of the pyramid, first president in 40 years to not disclose his tax returns. Then you go to the other leg of the pyramid and you go, what we've heard from press reports, published press reports, is much of the Trump organization's business is conducted through something called pass-throughs, where the enterprises, the people are treated for tax purposes as individuals rather than corporations. What was the part of the tax law that really favored a provision? Pass-throughs. So you have Russian money from 2009, you have not disclosing your taxes, and you have a part of the tax law that, based on public reports, is likely to be very favorable to the Trump business entities. So I'm staying with this question until those tax returns are released. I think it is so critically important. I've been on it. I've been on it for well over a year now, really going on 2 years now. We're just going to stay at it until we do it. And by the way, the Republicans in the Congress could have cooperated with me and others on doing this. There is a process, for example, in the Senate Finance Committee, where the committee can obtain the tax returns in a confidential way. In other words, we obtain the tax returns in a confidential way. We can examine them in a confidential way. And if we choose to then to say that there is such a public interest in them being released, we could have a vote. And if the vote were to pass, they would be released. Well, I haven't been able to get the Republicans to do that either. So I think what Mr. Behar is trying to do is a good idea and it's very much in line with what I've been up to here for almost 2 years.
Okay, the last two numbers were 312 and 314.
Hi, I'm Nancy Holmes and I'm from Seaside. And I wanted to just tell you a couple of things. And I do have a question. I appreciate you so. We were sitting here talking before you come out. I don't know what I'd do if I had one of these Republican senators. I've been very fortunate. I lived in California for years, and I had Senator Feinstein and Boxer. And then when I was in Nevada, I had Harry Reid, so that was super. And now I've got two fantastic senators, and it is terrific. But as a Democrat, and as someone who is watching a lot of the world go by with a crisis at least twice a day with this person and that we've got as president and all of these people that seem to be folding and following him, it's absolutely frightening. What I'd like is to have now and just consistently right through something that we can hang on. I think the Democrats, there are many really, really good leaders, and we can't have a leader of leaders, but we've got to have a really good message that will give me some hope. I don't know how many people heard the young Kennedy do the after speech the other night, the Democrats' response. He was terrific. It was back to those old days when things were wonderful and we could listen to Obama and get some inspiration. This young man was inspiring. But we need that almost every day. We need a leader of leader, and we need that message. Thank you.
I decided about 865 town hall meetings ago that I wouldn't make town hall meetings kind of official party gatherings and that sort of thing. So I can probably talk to you about that in the parking lot afterwards, okay? This question of party politics. But I just want to pass on to you something that happened last week whenever anybody gets a little down and the like. The senators on Tuesdays, we have caucus lunches. I'm sure Debbie, they've got things like that in Salem too for the various parties. And so the way it works on Tuesdays, there's a kind of leadership table up in the front, and Chuck Schumer and Patty Murray, and they have Pat Leahy because he's the appropriations man, and myself because of the taxes and finance. And so we're sitting there and we're just getting ready to start the meeting and kind of everybody's kibitzing. And I look over at the table next to me and I see Doug Jones having lunch there. And I said to myself, all right, there's a lot of stuff going on that I don't agree with, and people are frustrated about a lot of stuff, but this is the first time in more than 20 years that somebody from Doug Jones's state has sat in this room. So there's a lot going on in America, and we ought to kind of keep it in perspective, along with the record number of young people running for office that I talked about. My sense is the best politics is to really show that you're going to lead on the important issues. And I want to give you an example of what I've been involved in the last few weeks. We all know that one of the fastest growing aspects of healthcare costs is medicine, prescription drugs. And it's something that just hits you in the forehead when you're at a Freddy's or a Safeway or Walgreens or wherever it is you get it. You know, enormous outpatient costs for medicine, even if you have some coverage. You have a Medicare Advantage plan or you have something else that, you know, offers you some coverage, you still get clobbered with prescription drug costs. So I have really zeroed in on this, and in the last few weeks, I think I've teed this up for us to lead on this issue every step of the way in the months ahead. President Trump said in the campaign repeatedly that he was going to do something about prescription drug prices. Okay? He actually said, you can see it online, it's an amazing YouTube. He said it, pharma, you know, in that kind of special way he does. Pharma, they're getting away with murder. And yet, after he said that, he just nominated to head the health department an executive, a price-hiking executive from Eli Lilly. So we had the hearings. You can probably see it. Like everything else, there's a lot going on. But I went through drug after drug after drug. By the way, he was the head of the Lilly Pricing Committee. He had the last word on prices, and I went through drug after drug after drug where prices more than doubled on his watch. So we're going to, in the days ahead, show that America's going to have a choice between a president who says Pharma's getting away with murder and then puts in place somebody with a documented record of raising prices, and our efforts to change the law so Medicare can bargain to go after lower prices, so we go after the middlemen, these pharmaceutical benefit managers. People are going to see that there's a real difference, and they're going to see it on infrastructure. They're going to see it on roads and bridges and transportation systems. They'll see it on a whole host of issues. So I get your point. I get it loud and clear. We can talk about party issues outside and who's running and why and all the rest. But when you get discouraged, also think about the fact that Doug Jones is sitting in that room with Democratic senators where nobody from his state sat for well over two decades.
Hi, Ron. My name's Lewis Brown. And lately I've been hearing some speculation about the president's ability to push a button and start a nuclear war without anybody else getting in the conversation. And I was wondering if you could give us your understanding of that situation and what you and Congress might be able to do about that.
I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm not gonna pretend to be, and obviously there's a constitutional amendment for a process that's used. I think the president has made a few judgments, and I'll tell you what I think they are, and you can give me your reaction. The president has a hard core of about 37% support, and if you look, it hardly ever varies. In fact, after the State of the Union, it went up, I think, to 41, and everybody was going, wow, what happened? Who are the 4%? You know, because it has been 37% for month after month after month. And my sense is that the president has decided there are really four states that matter above all else, that that's what brought home the presidency. We're talking about Ohio, we're talking about Michigan, we're talking about Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. Those four states, he believes, are the reason he's at 1600 Pennsylvania. And practically every single day, you can almost set your clock by it, he offers the people of those states something he thinks they'll like. It might be a tweet, it might be an executive order, it might be a speech, it might be a bill, but practically every single day, you can almost set your clock by it, he offers those people something that they want. And in the State of the Union, and I think I'll remember it forever, the president really, it seems to me, and it was very carefully done, all but said that the dreamers, these young people who were brought to the United States when they were very young by parents who were undocumented and who have spent their whole lives in the United States, who I've met with often, they have great grades, they work two jobs, they're sending money to families, they're doing all the things that we'd expect of a really wonderful young person who's going to make a difference. The president all but said those were the kind of people who were part of these horrible gangs that had victimized that family, and it was so tragic what they went through. And I think a lot of people watching sort of got the idea that dreamers were illegal immigrants, and the illegal immigrants were the kind of people who had done those despicable things to that very sweet family that was at the State of the Union. So what we have to do is make sure that the facts get out, and that was why I took the time to describe what we're going to do if the president tries to fire Robert Mueller. It's why I said, here's where I think the opportunities are on domestic issues like health care costs and roads and bridges and transportation systems. The president committed legislative malpractice on infrastructure. And I use that word specifically, and Debbie knows about these kinds of issues. If the president on day one had said, you know, I'm from the business community, I can bring the business folks and the labor folks together, and we're going to have the best infrastructure plan ever with roads and bridges and rail, he would have had the country eating out of his hand. And he didn't do it. And in fact, we'll say this again, ma'am, as part of the contrast, he passed on the opportunity to get the money for a real infrastructure plan, because I and others said, if you're going to do tax reform, make sure that a portion of the $2.6 trillion that's sitting overseas because of bad tax laws, when it's repatriated, bring that money home for roads and bridges and infrastructure. And he didn't do that either. Why didn't he do it? As our commissioner really spotlighted, because he didn't want to have money for roads and bridges. He wanted to have money for tax cuts for his friends and for the multinational companies. So that's my sense of what's going on, sir, and I'll leave it to others to make analyses of psychiatric conditions. And there is a constitutional amendment process. Our colleague Earl Blumenauer has some ideas for, you know, improving it, and that may well be a good idea too.
If you don't mind, sir, that wasn't my question.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed.
Talking specifically about the ability to start a war by pushing a button without anybody.
I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Good. Okay. I thought you were asking about the president's.
No, not about Mr. Trump, although, because this is the situation where it becomes more obvious that it could be a problem. But any president can do this.
Got it.
Perhaps we ought not to have that protocol any longer.
I'm a co-sponsor, sir, of legislation that would constrain a president's ability to press that button himself unchecked. And in fact, In fact, I think you're going to see more and more focus on this issue for a variety of reasons. I think, obviously, I'm concerned about the president's statements about North Korea, and his statements at the State of the Union about North Korea. I think we're very unfortunate because we're starting to see some reconciliation between North Korea and South Korea with respect to the Olympics Games and the like. So it would have been a natural for the president to have said, well, the main reason we're starting to see improvements is because of my statements, and I'm going to build on it and all the rest. And instead, what he's continued to do is to up, you know, the rhetoric about Kim Jong-un and calling him Rocket Man and the like. So I think we, because of your good question and my misunderstanding the first part, we have probably covered two questions. One, the issue of mental, you know, capacity, being that I think he understands very well what he's doing for the reasons that I described. And second, with respect to North Korea and the president's ability to use what he calls the bigger button, and his button's bigger than the others, I'm a co-sponsor of legislation that would require his inability to do that without certain procedural checks. Under normal circumstances, I'm going to give you a hopeful sign. I'd say pretty hard to see, but you may have seen that last summer, the Congress did something almost unprecedented, and we really tied the president's hands on sanctions law. On the sanctions bill that was passed last summer, given the powers that the president has as commander-in-chief, we passed almost unanimously major legislation to tie his hands and make it hard for him to waive the sanctions, again, unilaterally. And you had virtually all the Republicans do it. And this week, in fact, one of the reports was due, and it was a provision that I care a lot about. It's the Treasury Secretary's report. It's really a name and shame provision where you name all the people, the wealthy people, the oligarchs closest to Putin. And the Treasury Secretary had so little interest in real accountability that what he did to satisfy his part of the sanctions law is he went to Forbes magazine, cut out an article about wealthy people in Russia, and pasted it into the report. And I and others said, you're making a mockery out of enforcement, and I called for declassifying the whole list so that the American people would actually get a sense and we would be able to have name and shame and find out who the Russian oligarchs are who are Putin's close buddies and putting up all the money for this. You covered with one question a lot of base.
The next two numbers must have been stuck together, but they're 309 and 310.
Hello, Senator. Welcome back to Astoria, and thank you for your service, sir. My question today is about homelessness, and if you don't mind, I'd like to preface it with something a little anecdotal. I mean, most of the people here, and I and you, we are all of an age, and you know, we can remember back 50 years. It was 48 years ago this year that I left Los Angeles, California to attend school out of state. Returning home each summer, I took a job as a commercial bank teller in downtown Los Angeles. My commute to work, if I did not want to be on the Pasadena Freeway, took me through Skid Row. And I'd like to talk about Skid Row of 1970 through 1974. It was a place where down and out were there, you know, these were people with all phases of down and out. In the afternoons, in various stages of inebriation, you would see mostly middle-aged men on the street. When I commuted in the morning, there was no one on the street. There was no one sleeping on the street. Apparently, these people did have enough money to at least get a bed in a flop house. Then we move into the 1980s when I go back to Los Angeles. And now people are living in cardboard boxes on Skid Row. They're pushing shopping carts on Skid Row, but they're beyond Skid Row now. They're in Pasadena, they're in San Marino, they're in Arcadia. And what happened in the early 1980s, I recall that the Reagan administration required anyone on Social Security disability to reapply. And it was at that time they threw a majority of the people off of this assistance, and this seems to be the blossoming of the homeless situation. So, feeling maybe somewhat optimistic, if the Democratic Party gets back in power in 2018 and in both houses, are we going to do something about this problem which has just been festering like an unchecked melanoma and keeps getting bigger and bigger every year?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You make an extraordinarily important point, and let me give you my take. And as with our gentleman who asked a good question, we ended up talking about two important areas. I want to give you a chance to have the last word. I think the disability changes that Ronald Reagan made were certainly a part of the problem, but I don't think it was the major consequence. And you tell me as well, is that, let me just finish this, that Ronald Reagan decided in the 70s, because as you know, he was elected president, that he wanted to take on mental health. And as far as I can tell, this was something where he was not trying to be malicious or hurtful to people of modest incomes. He made the judgment that he was going to empty California's mental institutions. And he said, and I've read all the speeches, I've gone back through it, that the reason he was going to do it is that he felt very strongly that it would be better for the state and better for the people if they were served in homes in the community and the like, and that would be more likely to allow them to have a fair measure of independence and the like. I mean, it was a compassionate speech. The problem was, after he emptied the mental health facilities, there weren't the places in the community. And so many of those people were on the streets until they hurt themselves or someone else. And I know a little bit about this personally because one of those people was my late brother, Jeffrey Allen Wyden, who suffered from schizophrenia And there wasn't a night that went by, not a single night went by, when we weren't concerned that he'd be out on the streets and he'd hurt himself or somebody else. So that's another piece of the puzzle in addition to what you're talking about. So I don't want to wait for just another election, because part of this is waiting around for elections. I just think you got to move and move now. And so what we're trying to do in the Finance Committee is, and if you're having trouble sleeping, I wrote a long essay on this for the Eugene Register Guard on changes in the disability law. And I did that about a week ago, and we're working that into a legislative effort. Second, there are two other areas that relate exactly to what the commissioner was talking about in terms of priorities for this community. A very large percentage of the people who are on the streets and who are homeless are suffering mental health infirmities for the reason that I'm talking about. And one of the reasons I so oppose what Donald Trump and the far right want to do with Medicaid is if they're successful, they'll hollow out Medicaid and we'll have even less help for those with mental health problems. I want to expand mental health coverage in America under the homeless provision, under Medicaid. And I want the insurance companies to honor what's in the law, which is to make mental health comparative to physical, you know, health. Those two things. And finally, there's one other part of this, and that is we need to expand housing for the homeless. And this tax bill actually hurts housing for the homeless, because we have the low-income housing tax credit, which I've been one of the ringleaders in supporting. We've had bipartisan support for it. For a lot of complicated reasons, this tax bill actually reduces the value of the low-income housing tax credit. So don't for a second let anybody off the hook on this homeless issue right now. We need changes in the disability law. We need changes in the health care laws, and particularly not cutting Medicaid. And we need to be expanding, not cutting, the low-income housing tax credit. Those three areas. And apropos of the person who asked the question about leadership and the like, I think those are the kinds of issues that if you show leadership on, the people are going to say, that's what we're looking for, because we've seen this problem get worse and worse. And as the gentleman so correctly said, it's come to a lot of communities that never believed that they were going to see it even 5 or 10 years ago.
Senator, it's turned from a problem into a situation. And it has pushed the economic burden onto local communities. And you're right that Ronald Reagan did that as governor in California. And we are also right that Ronald Reagan did that as president of the United States. And this is when we went from seeing middle-aged men on the street to seeing women on the street and to seeing children on the street.
I can just tell you, I spent years watching my younger brother push and pull and struggle his way through halfway houses and mental health facilities. And as I say, practically every night we expected a call late that he hurt himself or somebody else. And I am very, very determined to get this fixed. I've seen it, and I've seen families who didn't have the resources that we did suffer needlessly, and we've got to get it changed.
Senator Wyden, I do appreciate the fact that you're here, and I appreciate the fact that I live in Oregon, where I am represented by people that do the right thing. Most everyone in Oregon is represented by a Democrat that has a brain, and I appreciate that. In Seaside, at your last event, I asked you a question regarding availability of information regarding how medical marijuana can help individuals with issues. I left a message with one of your staff here today to possibly get an answer back regarding that. But my question today is, I'm looking for hope today. I'm looking for hope. And having grown up in Oregon for nearly 70 years, I came from a large extended family that was represented by not only Democrats, but Republicans. Republicans in the 50s and 60s were normal American people. And we always had attitude issues. Even as a child, we had political issues. But what we're seeing now makes me question whether or not the current day Republican gives a damn about America, about the United States of America. Most of them right now vote against what is the best for the largest number of American citizens. And I'm hoping that you can tell me there are some Republicans that won't allow our nation to be completely destroyed.
A couple of points. First, I've always believed deeply in what I call the Oregon way. You know, we're people who are independent and compassionate, and we like to think we take a good idea from wherever we see it, a Democrat or Republican, no matter what their party. I mean, I think there are plenty of Republicans that are very concerned about what they're seeing in Washington, D.C. right now. There are plenty of Republicans who tell me that this is not what the late Mark Hatfield was all about. This is not what Tom McCall was all about. I mean, we had, and I like to think that some of us are trying to pick up on this, that we had a special tradition of trying to find common ground, and it was coming up with ideas that help people first and doing the politics somewhat later. We lost a very, very wonderful Democrat here in the last few weeks, I think Debbie Neuer, who very much was part of the Oregon way with Tom McCall and Mark Hatfield, and that was Vera Katz, who is the mayor of Portland. And I'm looking around the room, I see some young people floating around there. I mean, I'm not sure those guys over there were born when Vera Katz was mayor. But she always was reaching out to rural communities. And she was mayor of Portland. And I remember one of the first conversations I had with her, she said, "Did you hear about the watermelon spitting contest?" No, I hadn't heard about that. Well, she had a pal who probably was one of the most conservative Republicans we ever saw, a fellow named Francis Harkenrider. But she wanted to get the word out about Oregon's fruits and vegetables, and we wanted to get them all over the world and global markets. And so they had a watermelon spitting contest in downtown Portland. But the point was that you didn't have all of this animosity that seems to dominate today's, you know, political discussions. So what I've tried to do is a couple things. One, to try to stick to the facts, look for opportunities for common ground. You might have seen Orrin Hatch and I wrote an op-ed for Time magazine. You can read it online here in the last couple days about how we managed, and the fights were sort of needless, but we managed to get the Children's Health Insurance Program reauthorized for 6 years, and we're going to come back. And I said, "Senator Hatch, you're retiring this year. I'm going to try to get this reauthorized for 10 years or permanent. And then in your retirement, you'll be able to think about something that really was great for kids." So I understand this animosity, and we could go on a lot longer for it, and I did in connection with one of the earlier questions, but I will tell you, I never believed growing up we would see television that was essentially for one political party or another. I mean, I grew up with Walter Cronkite, and he gave you the news. but it wasn't just TV that reinforced what one party or another believed. So that's another reason why it's so great that you all come for community meetings, so that we have a chance to talk about ways to bring people together rather than cause people to fight. And if I could, Arlene, can I just mention something that happened this week that ought to bring all of us together? And I'd really like everybody's help. This week, we had a hearing in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee where I was once the chairman, and I was taking on the people in the Trump administration who seemed to want to eliminate funding for the U.S. Geological Survey's West Coast Earthquake Early Warning System. This is the program called Shake Alert. And this is the program that gives you the most current information with the various technologies that my guess is some of you know more about than I do. And somehow, back in Washington, D.C., you got some people sitting in their comfortable, well-heated offices at the Office of Management and Budget, not paying any attention to what's really going on the Oregon coast, where you see tsunami signs practically, you know, every mile about, you know, warning signs. So I think that we need to get all the Democrats and all the Republicans all over the West and all up and down the coast to say to Mr. Mulvaney, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, earthquakes and tsunamis are serious, deadly business for our part of the world. And it isn't a question of if, but when the West Coast is going to need federal resources and support. And I hope that, apropos of the gentleman's very good question, that everybody, whether you're a liberal or a conservative or a Democrat or a Republican, I hope you'll be in touch with Mr. Mulvaney at the Office of Management and Budget and the White House and say that it is crucially important that you support the Shake Alert Early Warning System on the West Coast and support it until it's up, running, and ready to warn us if, heaven forbid, the worst happens. So I think your very constructive comment about bringing people together, that shouldn't be the kind of partisan issue that caused a lot of animosity. But I'll tell you, I walked out of that hearing room really pretty stunned, and the fellow who was testifying from the Geological Service knew that we sort of caught him, because he said in his oral testimony, he said, you know, we're really going to be able to get this up and running, even though you're concerned about the funding. And then I took his written testimony, which talked about how critical the function was, and I said, okay, mister, you can't reconcile these two, because what you said orally to the Senate of the United States and what you've said in writing doesn't square. And it certainly doesn't square for the people I represent on the Oregon coast, who I'm going to see on Saturday. And I said, I want an answer in writing as to what's the truth here. Because I can tell you, on the Oregon coast, people think this is deadly serious business. And I'm going to stay after the Trump people, Mr. Mulvaney, and the Geological Service until this community and the Oregon coast gets the help they need for the early warning system, period.
And I've been told this is the last question, 305.
It's a hand right there.
We've got a hand right there, Evan. Woman on the aisle.
Oh, here we are. First of all, thank you for your...
By the way, before you start, I also want to give a shout out before we wrap up to some really good folks who've been here. Former State Senator Joan Dukes is here. Where's Joan? We thank her. Remember lots of meetings with her. County Commissioner Kathleen Sullivan, we already saw. Seaside City Councilor Tita Montero is here. Where's Tita? great to see you, Gentita. Astoria City Council Member Thomas Brownson. Where's Thomas? Great to see you. And then, of course, our very own wonderful Debbie Boone, who's right up in front. Oh, excuse me. Thank you. See you. Good. Did I miss anybody else? Gerhard City Council. Let's have them all up on their feet. Thank you. All right. Okay. Biomass, alternative energy, and Trump. I'll comment on those things in the parking lot.
So ironically, I'm also running for that seat. there's a few of us here. My name is Melissa Oosley. I'm an advisor at Clatsop Community College, and I'm running for state representative for District 32. But my question for you, first I want to say thank you for your courage. I know it's been a challenging year, and you've really had to fight hard for the Oregon Way. But my question is, the Oregon coast, we bring in $2 billion in revenue for tourism. We have a lot of visitors to the coast. We really value the environment. Much of our economy depends on our oceans, fishing. We have a lot of visitors every year. So this thing with offshore drilling, absolutely not. Absolutely not on my watch. Absolutely not for all of the residents here. We feel pretty strongly about this, and so I just want to hear from you.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I were married out in front of Haystack Rock, and we were watching Mr. Zinke and all those people in the administration talk about this offshore drilling, and I said, I can't believe they're talking about having an oil derrick not far from Haystack Rock. And the irony, of course, here is that back in D.C., people have missed to a great extent what has happened in the last few years in terms of the outdoors and recreation economy. It is now a major economic engine, a really huge multiplier, and people are outside all during the day, and then they're going to restaurants and enjoying our craft brews and wine, you know, at night. And I don't think we're the only family in the United States that thinks that August is the best time in the world, because the Wyden Trio, pictures available on my iPhone. My wife and I are older parents, everybody knows this. That's where they want to be. They want August on the Oregon coast in Cannon Beach. And a big part of where I think, again, the political debate is going to be coming up is going to be our shaping this kind of wider lens of economic prosperity. That's what I've been calling it, a wider lens of economic prosperity. I think the Trump people think, well, we'll just sort of bring back the economics of yesteryear, and we'll send a bunch of those fossil fuel people out there to just go out and have at it, you know, off the coasts of the United States. And we're going to block them. And right at the center of it is going to be Democrats and Republicans, as we just heard from the earlier speakers say, you're not talking about today's economics. You're talking about something that might have been debatable 25 years ago, but isn't today. And the economics today in the West, to a great extent, involve looking with a wider economic lens at all of the possibilities for, you know, recreation and the industries, the restaurants, the motels, and others who offer services to all those people. Because literally, what you have on the Oregon coast for much of the year is people getting outside while it's light, and then they come inside, and they're also bringing dollars and support to rural communities. So I'm going to make that a special priority coming up. I've been one of the ringleaders in the effort to stop drilling off the coast in the past. 1 year I was a sponsor of the bill. I think this year we asked Dianne Feinstein to do it because California is obviously paying a lot of attention to this. But I feel very strongly about blocking that and making sure, as I just indicated from the last hearing in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, that you don't have the administration back in Washington, D.C., in effect turning its back on critical services like the early warning systems for tsunamis and earthquakes, that without which you kind of turn parts of the country into a sacrifice zone. And on my watch, that didn't go happen. So great question to wrap up, and I'm going to leave you with one last thought. I'm sure you walk out of here disagreeing with me about one thing or another. And by the way, let's give Arlene another round of applause for all she's done. You walk out of here disagreeing with me about one subject or two subjects, or maybe you walk out of here and say, I don't agree with Ron about anything. That's your constitutional right. But I hope you'll say, this is what the founding fathers wanted it to look like. I have been looking out for the last 90 minutes at the face of democracy, at the faces of people who want to work, for example, on the kind of recreational coastal economy for the future, not turn back the clock to yesteryear, who are concerned about leadership, you know, on healthcare and infrastructure and taxes. And I continue to believe that we can get this right. One of my very favorite sayings, for a while it was attributed to Winston Churchill, but it was actually Abba Iban, the Israeli diplomat, who said it. One afternoon in a big debate where there was great frustration about the United States, apparently Abba Iban got up and said, "The Americans always get it right after they've tried everything else." And looking at what's going on back in Washington, D.C., you got to say to yourself, we got to make sure that's everything else. And we're going to move forward with the kind of agenda that meets the needs of the coast and meets the needs of Oregon and our country. And as long as I have the honor to represent you in the United States Senate, this is the way we're going to do it. Thanks, everybody.